We're very pleased to continue our study in the book of John today. We're now in the midst of the 20th chapter of John, and we're studying about the appearances that Jesus made after his resurrection. And in our last lesson, we were teaching about the third appearance that he made. And to get the account of this third appearance, we're reading from the book of Luke, Luke 24, and that account begins with the 13th verse. Here Luke tells about two disciples that were traveling from Jerusalem to a village known as Emmaus. We don't know exactly where Emmaus was. It was probably a village about 7 or 8 miles northeast of Jerusalem. And as they were walking along, Jesus drew near and went with them. And these disciples were talking about the events that had just happened, about his trial and crucifixion and burial. They had no idea that he was resurrected. They even were having great doubts that he was the Messiah. They were now calling him a great prophet that did great works and spoke great words, but they didn't look upon him as the Messiah. And they were really disappointed because he'd been put to death, and they were looking for the fact that he should have redeemed Israel. And they felt like that he failed in doing that. And so after making that statement, Jesus then began to upbraid them. He criticized them. He said, "O fool and slow of heart, to believe all that the prophets have spoken, ought not Christ have suffered these things and to enter into his glory?" And so he began there and taught them from the scriptures. He went over all the things in the scriptures concerning himself. And so, as we said in the last lesson, this must have been a very great Bible lesson that he taught, to have had the master himself to expound it upon all these prophecies and to explain them and the fulfillment of them. And of course, they had come to pass now so far as his death and burial were concerned. And so we learned that as they drew near to the village, Jesus pretended that he would go on further with his journey, but they constrained him to stop with them here at this village and said, "Abide with us, for it's toward evening and the day is far spent." And he went in to tarry with them, verse 29. And it came to pass, as he sat at meat with them, he took bread and blessed it and brake and gave to them, and their eyes were open, and they knew him. Now, this description here of his taking of the bread and blessing it and breaking it and giving it to them is practically identical to the description given of his establishment of the Lord's Supper or the communion. And so it has to be that these disciples, seeing this very same thing done by the Savior here, this is the way that they recognized him. This is such a unique act, one that had just been instituted by him a few days before. It could have been no coincidence that some stranger would have sat down with them and done this very same thing. This then opened their eyes and they knew him. This was a way to know him. Now, we'd like to notice a significant thing here. This act of communing by breaking the bread and taking it in joint participation, which we call the communion, accompanied with the drinking of the fruit of the vine. This act is something that we are to do today. We do it on the first day of the week, which is the same day they were doing it here. This was the evening of his resurrection, the first day of the week. We do it to see him, to discern him, to see his body, and that's the way they were able to see him. When he did this, their eyes were open and they knew him. This is the way they knew him, by this act of breaking of bread here. And so there seems to be more than just a coincidence here that it happened on the first day of the week, and it was a way for them to identify and recognize him. They knew him by the thing that was done here, and that's the way we know him today. We see him in these elements that represent his body and that represent his blood when we commune today. So their eyes were open, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight. And Mark describes this appearance to them in the words by saying that he had another form. So his body was not the same as our body is. It was a recognizable body. He did have flesh and bones. He did still have the same imprints of the nails in his hands and feet and the wound in his side. But it was not the same kind of a body. It was a different form. And so as Luke describes it here, he says that he vanished out of their sight. And so he might have just disappeared as he was sitting there eating with them. We learned that he could go through closed doors with this body that he had. So it was a different kind of a body. Well, after he vanished, verse 32 says, "And they said one to another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way and while he opened to us the scriptures?" Here were disciples that were genuine. They wanted to know the truth. They weren't trying to manufacture some fabricated story about his resurrection, but at the same time, if he did really resurrect, they wanted to know this because they were going to be dedicating their lives to it. And when the scriptures were taught and they had the truth given to them and they could understand what the scripture was saying, then they describe it like this: did not our heart burn within us? This set them on fire. This gave them a zeal. This gave them an inspiration. This gave them a spiritual uplift that nothing else could do. And so that's the way it's described. And it's, of course, something that should have a very similar effect upon us. As we study and learn about these prophecies, as we see their fulfillment, it should make our heart also burn within us. It should make us have a spiritual zeal that we would not have in any other way. And it's based upon the truth, not on some fiction or some fable or some tradition that somebody just handed down, but it's based upon the truth that comes from the open scriptures. And then verse 33 of Luke 24, and they rose up the same hour and returned to Jerusalem. Now these disciples knew that a great thing had happened. Here the Messiah certainly was resurrected. They'd seen him. They'd experienced this. They'd witnessed it. And so they decided that this little place of Emmaus was no place for them to be right now. They might have been on their way on back up towards Galilee, but they decided to go back to Jerusalem and join the other disciples. So they returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 gathered together and them that were with them. So they found the other disciples gathered back in Jerusalem and them that were with him, saying, the Lord is risen indeed and hath appeared to Simon. Now these other disciples had some evidence now of his resurrection because he had appeared to Simon. And no doubt Simon had given them a detailed account of this appearance that he made to him. And they were telling these two disciples that came back from Emmaus about it. And verse 35, and they told what things were done in the way, and how he was known to them in breaking of bread. So this is the way he made himself known, by the breaking of bread. It was a unique thing for him to take the bread like this, and they identified him because they connected it with his using the same method when he instituted the Lord's Supper. We'd like to note here that as these disciples in Jerusalem, these 11, were telling the two disciples from Emmaus what had happened, they said the Lord is risen indeed and hath appeared to Simon, verse 34 here, that this happens to be what we will call the fourth appearance that Jesus made when he appeared to Simon. And this is also recorded in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5, and there in 1 Corinthians 15, beginning with the fourth verse, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas, and then of the 12. So Paul records, in writing to Corinthians, the fact that Jesus was seen of Cephas, and we see it here given by Luke, that he appeared to Simon. So that will be the fourth appearance, and we just studied the third appearance, now the fourth appearance. So our next study is going to be having to do with the fifth appearance that he makes. This fifth appearance of Jesus will also occur on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. It's going to be in Jerusalem, where the 10 apostles are assembled in an upper room. We're going to be studying from Mark, Luke, and John as we talk about this fifth appearance. This occurred while the apostles were assembled together, and the two disciples that he had appeared to in Emmaus had returned back to Jerusalem, and as they were telling their story of Jesus having appeared to them, then Jesus appeared in the midst of this group. This is the fifth appearance. So we go to Mark chapter 16 and beginning with the 14th verse. Afterwards he appeared unto the 11 as they sat at meat. Now Mark calls this the 11, but it was probably 10 apostles because we're going to read that Thomas was absent from this group. And he may just be referring to the 11 here because that's the way you would generally refer to the group of apostles. He appeared to the 11 as they sat at meat and upbraided them with their unbelief and hardness of heart because they believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. Now this group in general had not seen Jesus yet. They had only been given the message by those who had learned that he had resurrected from the grave, and they didn't believe their message. Mark says that he upbraided them. That is, he scolded them. He chided them because they had this thing called as unbelief and hardness of heart. Now, these are not necessarily two of the same things. Unbelief can simply be caused by ignorance. A failure to know something can cause you to have unbelief. But hardness of heart means that your heart is not receptive to the truth once it is presented to you. Your heart is hardened. The heart does not allow truth to come in. Does not allow new facts to be presented to it and to be received. And so they're really not the same thing, although hardness of heart can cause unbelief. And so we have to be most careful that we not have this thing known as hardness of heart, that we have a receptive mind, a mind that is willing to receive new information, new facts, things that may be truth that we are not aware of. And so they had so set themselves that they weren't even willing or ready to believe the fact that he had resurrected from the grave, that he still was the Messiah. They'd already decided this was somebody else. It wasn't really the Son of God because he'd been put to death. And so he upbraids them for this. And it's something that they deserve to be upbraided for. And we today need to be most cautious that we are ready and able to receive new truth. It won't be actually new truth, but it'll be new to us. And so as we study through the Bible, we're going to continually be coming across passages that are going to teach us things that we didn't know about before. And we must have an open mind, an open heart, a receptive heart, not a hard heart, so that we can receive these new pieces of information and then not be guilty of the unbelief that results from the hardness of heart. And so he upbraided them for this because they had believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. And verse 15, "And he said unto them, Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." Now here we have what is known as the Great Commission. This is the commission that Jesus gives to his apostles. It is not a commission that really applies to everybody in the same sense that it does to the apostles. It's not the first commission he'd given to them. He'd sent out his apostles to preach before and commissioned them to do that. But now this is the thing that's commonly known as the Great Commission. Each of the four Gospels records this in one way or another, and it's not always given on the same occasion that each apostle records it, but this is the version given by Mark. "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." That's the commission given to these apostles here. That's what they are told to do. That is going to be their job of work. Now, they got a tremendous task ahead of them to try to accomplish this. And we're going to read about much of this happening in the book of Acts, although we do not know all of the activities that these apostles went through. We don't know all the places they went, all the things that they did. And we do know, though, that they were commissioned to do this. Jesus gave them this command to do it. And he'd already said earlier that if you love me, keep my commandments. And here's one of the commandments they would have to keep to prove their love to him. He further says, in connection with this, going into all the world and preaching the gospel to every creature, he further says, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned." So it's the message they were going to give that would be the thing that would be the power to bring about salvation. It's a matter of believing the message. And of course, to believe the message strongly tells us that you must also obey the message. So to just believe and not obey is really not to believe. You cannot believe something and not obey it. So he says, "He that believeth and is baptized." So a part of this message was going to be the teaching about baptism, the teaching that one should be baptized, as Peter's going to say on the day of Pentecost, for remission of sins. And so to believe is going to include the practice of baptism. And of all the things that Jesus might have said in this commission to the apostles, here Mark records this fact, that he said, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." So we cannot leave out the necessity of baptism, just as we cannot leave out the necessity of believing. We must believe, we must act upon that belief, and a part of the belief is going to include the fact that baptism is taught as one of the things that believers should do. And here again, this goes along with what he taught earlier. If you love me, keep my commandments. That's the way we can prove to him our love for him, is to keep his commandments, and certainly baptism is definitely one of his commandments. And then he says, "He that believeth not shall be damned." I mean, there's no need to go into all the things that the unbeliever would not do. Just simply not believe is going to cause him to fall short of the command here. He's going to leave out the things, maybe not all things, but many things that are going to be taught that a believer should do. "He that believeth not" is going to leave those out necessarily, because he's not even going to believe them, and he's going to be damned. So our salvation hinges upon our belief and our following what we believe. That's what salvation hinges upon. And to not believe is to be damned. And then Jesus says in verse 17, "And these signs shall follow them that believe." Now he's giving a prediction here, giving a promise that these signs, and he's going to name some of the things that are included in this phrase, "these signs shall follow them that believe." This promise was fulfilled. This prophecy that he gives here did come to pass. They did have these signs to follow them. We have many examples of this having happened. It does not mean that every believer had these signs, and it doesn't mean that we have them today. They happened during the time in which the church needed these miracles to prove that the teachers were from God, during the time that the New Testament was being written, when it did not even exist. There were no New Testament scriptures to verify these things like we have today. The New Testament had not been completed. The full Bible wasn't completed. They did not have that which is perfect, which we have today, which is the Word. And so these miracles were necessary. These signs were necessary. And so Jesus says, "And these signs shall follow them that believe in my name." "In my name" means they're going to have his authority, the power that he vested in them. They're going to be able to use that. "In my name," he says, "shall they cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them, they shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." So he named some of the things that were going to come to pass that would be done by these believers, by these apostles, those men receiving this commission here, things that would be done by them in his name. And the purpose would be to prove that they were from God. They were establishing a religion in the world that had never been. They were going among nations that had never served the true or even heard of the true and living God. They needed some means here that they did not have as ordinary humans to show that they were from God, from the true and living God. And so these things were given them to do. They did have this power. Jesus predicts it here, and it came to pass. We can prove without any shadow of a doubt from other writings in the Bible that these things were accomplished. So what he says here did come to pass, and no one today can say, well, just because the church can't do these things today, that this was a false prophecy. It wasn't intended for the church to do it today. These things were done at the time that they were meant to be done. They fully fulfilled this prophecy given by Jesus here. And we can have every confidence that what he said then did certainly come to pass. So we see in this 16th chapter of Mark, we not only have the account of Jesus' fifth appearance to his disciples, but we also have the commission that he gives them, which is also recorded by all of the other gospel writers. And so it's important for us to know about this commission. We're going to get other views of it as we read from Luke and Matthew and John. But Mark's recording of this event gives us some information here that we do not get from the other three Gospels. As we continue our study of this fifth appearance that Jesus made, we'd like to look at Luke's account of this now, in Luke 24, beginning with the 36th verse. "And as they thus spake, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them, and saith unto them, Peace be unto you." This is still the first day of the week, Sunday. These two disciples that he met in Emmaus had gotten back to Jerusalem now, and they had met with the apostles, and as they were talking to the apostles, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them and saith unto them, Peace be unto you. Jesus made his appearance to them. And we're going to learn that all the apostles were present here except Thomas, when we read the account of this given in the book of John. And verse 37 says, "But they were terrified and affrighted, and supposed that they had seen a spirit." They couldn't believe what this was they were seeing. They still just could not make themselves realize that the Savior was here. He had come back from the dead. He was now in their presence. And suppose they had seen a spirit. "And he saith unto them, Why are you troubled? And why do thoughts arise in your hearts?" Now we learn in Mark that Mark said that he upbraided them because of their unbelief and hardness of heart. And so here they just would not believe it when they saw it. And so he says, "Why are you troubled, and why do thoughts arise in your hearts?" That he knew what their thoughts were. They were having all kinds of thoughts evidently here, trying to explain this thing away as being something besides what it really was. They just were not prepared to believe the fact that he'd come back from the dead. And they were troubled at the thought that maybe he has come back from the dead. And so he tells them in verse 39, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. for a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have. So he tries to demonstrate to them as graphically and as plainly as he can that it is certainly he. He shows them his body. Now we know that he has some kind of a different body. He appeared in a different form, Mark says. But he still has the print of the nails in the hands and feet. He still has that wound in his side. And Luke says to behold and handle my hands and my feet. John says my hands and my side. John is the only one who tells about the wound in the side, about them piercing his side, and so it would be most appropriate for John to mention the side wound. So just what kind of a body this was, we do not know. It still had these wounds in it, the marks of the wounds there, which had been given only a little over 3 days before, and he'd been dead for 3 days and three nights, so there had been no healing to take place during the time of death. And so the body was one that still supported these signs of wounds, but nevertheless, it was an intact body. And when he had thus spoken, he showed them his hands and his feet. So he gives them very graphic evidence here that it certainly is I myself, as he says. We read in Revelation 6 and 5 about him being there as a lamb, as it were, slain, as though he may still have these marks even in heaven. We read of those that pierced him should look upon him as though he's going to have these marks when he comes back again. These are his signs of victory over the grave. And he bears these marks just as any other conqueror would bear the marks that he gets on his body when he's achieving a great victory. And he uses these marks here on this occasion to prove to his apostles that it truly is he that is resurrected from the grave. We must close our lesson at that point. Next time we will continue in this fifth appearance of Jesus before his disciples. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.